In our study tonight, we're going to go back just a little bit and start again in chapter 1. Got your attention, didn't it? Verse 1 of chapter 8. Boy, I wish you could have had a camera and seen the expressions. Chapter 8 and verse 1 again, because I'm not happy with at least my efforts in the presentation of the study last Wednesday evening. And I may not be happy with the presentation, at least, of my efforts in the class this evening as well. I mentioned to somebody that sometimes you can study and study and study and study and spend a great deal of time on a bit of material and then find something that kind of rattles your cage and makes you wonder if what you've studied has been profitable or beneficial or even helped you to arrive at the right conclusions. And so I'm kind of there this evening, so I would appreciate your comments and now, I may not appreciate your questions, but I would appreciate your comments in our study this evening and would consider that very helpful as we study along. We've noted that in this context that the date that is assigned to the chapter is the third year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. We discussed that in our study last Wednesday evening. This would put it at about 552 B.C., 2 years later than the vision of Daniel in chapter 7. Now, one of the things that is helpful, I think, in some respects, and yet may be confusing in other respects, is to recognize that the book of Daniel is not necessarily set to a chronological order. So that presents us with some difficulties sometimes. For example, in chapter 5, in verses 30 and 31, chapter 5, verses 30 and 31, it sets the stage: in that night Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. But yet we're here reading about Belshazzar and events that take place in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. So to consider the events exactly in chronological order is not necessarily helpful to us and might be somewhat confusing to us. So we want to realize that though there is an overlay of information from chapter to chapter, it doesn't necessarily present itself in a chronology that's just real easy to discern and to make application of throughout the book consistently. And then in this vision, Daniel saw himself at Susa, as we have identified it on the map, in the province of Elam, that's western Persia, modern-day Iran, and it was the winter capital of the Persian kings. He found himself by the river Ulay. And we have, I think I left the map on here, to identify the place where Daniel is, or Daniel sees himself. Now, in our previous discussion, we noted that there are two possibilities. One is that Daniel might see himself in the vision at this place. And then the second possibility is that he very well might be here, as this was a winter capital of the Persian Empire. But be that as it may, what he saw, I think, takes on added significance. In Daniel 8, verses 3 and 4, let's read that again. It says, "Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, and no beast could stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and magnified himself." This, I think, is a passage that is helpful, or the text itself is helpful, when we look over into the 20th verse, because some of these things are identified for us. It says, "The ram which thou sawest that had the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia." Now, in our study last week, I believe, we learned that the length of these horns is different. One was larger than the other, indicating a dominance of power by the Persian kings over those of Media. And I think this is consistent not only with the wording of the text, but also, as Terry has pointed out a number of times, the text is consistent with known history. And this has to fit, and it certainly does, with known history and even from the context. But further it tells us in verse 5 that he saw a one-horned male goat that came suddenly from the west across the surface of the whole earth, not touching the ground. Now, we've used expressions in times past of someone going so fast it was as if they never touched the ground. And I think the implications here has to do with a king that moves so fast that he is described as one that didn't touch the ground. He's also described as having a notable horn between his eyes. This is fitting, I think, not only with the text which identifies this he-goat in verse 21 as the king of Greece, and it says the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that would identify for us Alexander, who pushed east with rapid expansion of his kingdom, as we see in the text, identified as the Greek Empire. Furthermore, we notice that this goat defeated the ram, verses 6 and 7. And he came to the ram that had the two horns, which I saw standing before the river, and ran upon him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with anger against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled upon him. And there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. And the he-goat magnified himself exceedingly. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four notable horns toward the four winds of the heaven. Now, Alexander, again, the king of the Greek Empire, defeated the Persians, and we can assign a historical date to that and know about when that happened and learn that that's consistent with world history. The goat became great. The large horn was broken. And it's here that I want to discuss some things with you. In its place, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. In our previous discussion, we talked about how that when Alexander's kingdom became weak, it was overpowered or taken over by four kings or four generals that each divided up and had a portion of the land over which Alexander ruled. And we talked about the one, Ptolemy, that was given assumed the authority over Egypt, Seleucus, Assyria, Cassander, Macedonia, and Greece. And Lysimachus over Thrace and Asia Minor. And it's here that I frankly have some difficulties in my study of where to go from here. Now, in our study last time, we talked about in verses 9 through verse 12 this little horn that came out of the four with great power, which grew exceedingly great. And we can read this if you would like, and I think that might be helpful to us. Again, a friend of mine several years ago said, you can never go wrong when you're reading from the text. You know you've got that part right. It's when you begin to comment on the text that we begin to create some difficulties and problems even for ourselves. And so anyway, verses 9 through verse 12, it says, and out of one of them came forth a little horn which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the glorious land. Now, the glorious land, we identified that as the land of Palestine, the land of Canaan that was given to the Jews. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and of the stars it cast down to the ground and trampled upon them. Yea, it magnified itself even to the prince of the host, and it took away from him the continual burnt offering, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And the host was given over to it, together with the continual burnt offering, through transgression. And it cast down truth to the ground, and did its pleasure and prospered. Now this expression, did its pleasure and prospered, is one that occurs a number of times in the writing of Daniel, to indicate, I think, that these kings did what they pleased. They had power and authority, and they exerted that power and authority. But this that is spoken of in verses 9 through 12, at least appears to me to be one of these four kingdoms, or one of these four that descended from Alexander and became exceedingly great. The power that is discussed in these verses may be referenced in verse 23 through 25, and this is where my confusion begins to kick in. It says, "And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding, dark sentences, shall stand up, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power." Now you see that expression is used in the context that we just read from verses 9 through verse 12. But to comment just a little bit on verses 9 through verse 12, and I don't think that's where I want to be in the charts. Here we go. This is possibly, and I want to underscore the word possibly, Antiochus Epiphanes, the ruler of Syria, who became ruler about 175 and died in 164 B.C. He imposed Greek culture. He also imposed deity upon his subjects. He conquered the city of Jerusalem, as it were, and took the temple, set up images in the temple, offered swine upon the altar, encouraged Greek soldiers to commit fornication in the temple, and forbade circumcision, keeping the Sabbath, and possessing a copy of the Scriptures. And the consequences of these things, if one violated them, was death. Now Josephus tells us a little bit about that, as well as what we're going to reference in just a little bit from the historical account of 1 Maccabees. And we'll talk about what that is in just a little bit. But he saw a little horn come up out of the four with great power. Now what did he do? It tells us that he grew up to the host of heaven, casting down and trampling to the ground some of the host, exalting himself as high as the prince of hosts, and called himself God. Now, there can't be any doubt that Antiochus did that, but whether he's the one that's being spoken of in this context is the thing that I question. It tells us that he saw a little horn come out of the four with great power, and by this powerful horn, number one, the daily sacrifices were taken away, the place of God's sanctuary was cast down, and an army was given him to oppose the daily sacrifices because of transgression. He did all this and prospered, the text tells us. Now, in light of those things, here is a summary that Maccabees, 1 Maccabees, gives us of the things that Antiochus did. And I want to take a moment. If you don't have, and let me say this cautiously, if you don't have a Catholic Bible and you have the opportunity to pick one up real cheap, I would encourage you to get one because, not because that the books that are in it are all inspired, but it does contain some books that are simply books of history. They're not to be considered as inspired books because some of them contradict each other, and some of them most definitely contradict what the text itself says. Now, for that purpose, we want to say that and get that up before everybody. So we're not recognizing these books that are contained in or as additional books in the Catholic Bible as authoritative or as inspired, but simply as portions of history that help us to understand the period of time that existed between the closing of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. How much time transpired between the two testaments? 400 years, yes. And when we consider 400 years, we recognize that from God's perspective as 400 years of silence. But that doesn't mean that events just stop happening. Events continued to happen. And where do we read about those to find out what occurred as far as history is concerned during that period of time? Well, we can learn some things from 1 and 2 Maccabees, books of history, that are contained as authoritative in the Catholic Bible. Now that tells you that the Catholics decided to include those books. They're not to be included in Scripture, but they are helpful, and let me reiterate that, to understand what transpired during those times of silence when God no longer communicated with His people. Now having said that, does anybody think that Mick believes that these books in the Catholic Bible are inspired? Good. I'm glad I made that clear. Does anybody think that Mick believes that we need to include these in our Bible? Well, good. I made that real clear. Now, I want to recognize that from the standpoint, watch it now, from the standpoint of history, we're looking at 1 Maccabees chapter 1, and I want to read with you verse 31, and then we'll read several successive passages. It says, "And he spake to them peaceable words in deceit, and they believed him." Now, the context of this passage is that Antiochus despoils the temple. That's what's being discussed. And it tells us that the things that he did were very deceitful. In other words, he presented himself as a friend and then didn't do that. He came through and defeated these people. Comment, Terry, or question before I go on with this? I know that what Antiochus did, I can identify those things with Antiochus, and that seems consistent.
But let's notice back in the 7th chapter, in the first verse, we have, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. So there's a vision that Daniel receives in the first year of Belshazzar. And notice that this vision in the 8th chapter comes, as you pointed out, in the 3rd year of Belshazzar.
Right.
So, on the timeline, this vision here, the context you're talking about is after the vision in chapter 7. Okay?
It is, but I have a question.
When this vision in chapter 7 is explained, starting with, say, verse 15 and going forward, okay? notice that the explanation is that these four beasts are four kings which arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom of the kingdom. And then in verse 19, it jumps right to the fourth beast.
Okay. Right. I don't deny that chapter 7 is dealing with Rome.
But it jumps right to the fourth beast. But what I'm saying is that I wouldn't necessarily really look at this historical record of Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes, maybe with that much doubt, because it appears that there's a lot in chapter 7 in that vision about the fourth beast and how we're going to identify that fourth kingdom, how you're going to know that this is the fourth kingdom talked about. But you see, there's a lot of detail that, if you will, is not filled in chapter 7. And on the timeline, on the historical record that you're talking about, these verses here that you brought up, say 9 through 12, one way you could look at these verses is that these verses are filling in some of the historical details of this whole time about what's going to happen to the Jewish people. Okay?
I agree, but the thing that troubles me is, in this overlay, whether or not the Roman kings of the 7th chapter are identical in the overlay to the things that are discussed in the 8th chapter. And my reason is this: when Daniel is seeing the vision, they're separate visions. And I have questions in my mind whether or not the 8th chapter then becomes a sequence in the chain of events, or rather just simply an overlay of the chain of events that very well might be discussing some other details.
I'm not sure we've quite gotten to that particular
Yeah.
All I'm saying is that one way to think about these verses relating to one of the four great kingdoms is that these are filling in details that didn't exist in this vision over in, that weren't part of the vision.
But might be leading up to? Right.
Because it does do that in chapter 7. It jumps, the vision is not really about Babylon or
right.
so much the Medes and Persians or about the Greeks.
It's about Rome.
It jumps right to the fourth kingdom. And now, in this next vision, God is going to start filling in some of the details.
Talking about the Medes and the Persians
talking
and the Greeks.
About the Medes and the Persians, and in particular, one of the four Greek kingdoms.
Okay, which may very well be Antiochus.
Which might very well be Antiochus, but I think your other question about is this the Roman we read about or not? I think we're possibly going to start discussing some. I think
soon.
There's some of that, or how can I put it, the very first point, I think, where you may have to deal with that in this chapter is in particular in verse 19.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking even a little bit later than verse 19, but perhaps so.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. David?
Well, what sells it for me is verse 14.
Okay. Okay. Yes. That's one of the things that kind of swayed me.
Right, because you've got your timeline, you know, he's filling in, and it says when the sanctuary will be
cleansed.
You know, cleansed, but justified, I think is the word I saw somewhere. And that happened in the book of Maccabees. It talks about 164. Yeah, with the Maccabees, they got all that stuff out. And that, so that, to me, puts the timeline that you were working with this time. So that would exclude the Romans.
Be too early for the Romans.
Yeah, be too early.
Okay.
It talked about the sanctuary being desecrated and all that, and then it's cleansed and justified. And that's in verse 14. So then that, to me, when I was reading, thinking, well, it's not talking about the Romans, like Terry said. He's going back and filling in Medo-Persian and the Greek.
Okay.
And that kind of sets the date or the timeline.
Okay. All right.
This is too early to be, as we see, you mentioned, starting now and on into chapter 12. This is not the time of the end.
No, not yet. No, not yet.
After the Romans destroyed the temple.
No, it was over. Right. There wasn't going to be any reconstruction or cleansing of the sanctuary. That's true. These things that Antiochus did, let's read from 1 Maccabees, and I want you to listen carefully, because these things, as far as history is concerned, I think are quite interesting. I'm reading now from 1 Maccabees chapter 1 at verse 46. And the king sent letters by the hands of the messengers to Jerusalem and to all the cities of Judah, that they should follow the law of the nations of the earth, and should forbid holocaust and sacrifice and atonements to be made in the temple of God, and should prohibit the Sabbath and the festival days to be celebrated. And he commanded the holy places to be profaned, and the holy people of Israel. And he commanded altars to be built, and temples, and idols, and swine's flesh to be immolated, and unclean beast. And that they should leave their children uncircumcised, and let their souls be defiled with all uncleanness and abominations, to the end that they should forget the law, and should change all the justifications of God, and that whosoever would not do according to the word of King Antiochus should be put to death. According to all these words he wrote unto the whole kingdom, and he appointed rulers over the people that should force them to do these things. And they commanded the cities of Judah to sacrifice, Then many of the peoples were gathered to them, or gathered to them that had forsaken the law of the Lord, and they committed evils in the land. And they drove away the people of Israel into lurking holes and into the secret places of fugitives. And on the 50th day of the month, Kislew, I believe it is. 15th day. You're reading from that too, huh? On the 15th day, in the 145th year, King Antiochus set up the abominable idol of desolation upon the altar of God. And they built altars throughout all the city of Judah round about. And they burned incense and sacrificed at the doors of the houses and in the streets. And they cut in pieces and burnt with fire the books of the law of God. And every one of them, or every one with whom, rather, the books of the testament of the Lord were found, and whosoever observed the law of the Lord, they put to death according to the edict of the king. And, of course, in verse 63, it says, now the women that circumcised their children were slain according to the commandment of King Antiochus. That's very descriptive of the kind of things that we're reading about that pertain to the defiling of the temple and the need for the temple to be cleansed. Now, David, you made a point regarding verse 14. We'll get to that. I've got a chart on that. But raising the question, who is Antiochus? I think, Randy, you raised that question in our study last time. He's surnamed Epiphanes. Now, he assumed these names. But the name Epiphanes means God, or manifest God. Some, because of the atrocities of this man, called him manifest madman because of the terrible things that he did. But he succeeded his brother Seleucus to the throne, one of the four generals following Alexander. And he reigned from about 175 to 164.
That's not one of the four generals.
Oh, he wasn't.
That's a descendant.
That's right.
I think that's Seleucus IV.
That's right. That is right. I remember reading
and
that.
And then the first was the general.
That's right.
He had these guys that succeeded him.
That is right.
I think the first took control of.
I don't remember the date, but I remember the distinction. Yeah.
I was noting as you were reading along that it used the word, in that translation, it used the word Antiochus several times. However, it's not in the King James Version. It's only in the Good News Translation. And I know, as I look in the Septuagint, it's not in the Septuagint either. So I assume that's the Good News Translation.
This is the Douay.
Douay.
1609
Douay. Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Douay has that also. Yeah. So it's interesting to note that of the four or five translations that I have here, that two of them use King Antiochus, but the others don't. And if I look at the Septuagint, it doesn't have his name.
What does it use?
Yeah, what does it use?
It just uses the king.
Okay. So it could be admitted that this is the king that did these things. In fact, I think this is the king without dispute that did these things that are identified in this context. I think that fits with the historical record as well. And of course, on the chart, you'll notice that he organized an expedition against Jerusalem, which he destroyed, putting vast multitudes of its inhabitants to death in the most cruel manner. Well, that's what we've read.
I was just going to point out that Ptolemy had Palestine. The Ptolemy dynasty had Palestine
from Egypt.
For Egypt and Palestine for years and years and years. And then it talked about him coming out of heading to the glorious land. And then that's when the Seleucids started taking over, and they gained Palestine.
Yeah.
They tried to get Egypt. I think there was some big battles, but I don't think they ever really held it. I think they won some battles, but didn't actually hold on to it.
I read some of that. I don't remember the details of it. I was reading some online.
The thing was, the Ptolemies gave the Jews a little more free reign, and that was one of the big problems, was when the Seleucids came in, and they started really trying. The other ones were very liberal in teaching them the Greek way, the Hellenistic way, Ptolemies were very tolerant for the solutions were very dogmatic.
Right. Richard?
I was going to say, I think you mentioned that you have Barnes' Old Testament. He's mm-hmm. got a pretty good rundown of all these kings in his rundown of Daniel 8:8, where it talks about these, that he'd go, you know, destroying the other ones and the horns and all that sort of stuff. He's got a pretty good history of what's going on in Barnes' notes for Daniel 8:8.
I don't know how many of you have access to Barnes' notes. You might find that online. He's one of the, in a lot of the material that I have been reading, he's one that's listed in the bibliography of a good bit of the material, which is helpful to me when I'm reading some material to find out what sources they used in coming to the conclusions. Barnes' notes on the book of Daniel. If you have that, he has some good material, or at least some material that you might like to read. It makes some good research. Yeah, whether it's good or not, it makes some good research. I find it interesting in the text. It says that whoever this was, and I think that we're perhaps talking about Antiochus here, that he would die and he would not die by the hand of men. Interestingly enough, from this time the Jews began to try to declare their independence. And this brings us to the Maccabean revolt or Maccabean period. Where they tried to oppose the armies of Antiochus that were sent against them. Now, Antiochus, having sent generals to them, he's determined now to conquer Jerusalem. And because of the opposition led by Judas Maccabees, the king Antiochus comes himself to fight against Jerusalem and conquers the city. At least at the onset. But the idea that he would die, and he would not die really at the hand of someone in war, he died, and he died at the early age of 51 years old, but he died of disease. And I find that just interesting, that the context of our study indicates that he would not die by the hand of men, but he did die, and he died by disease. God did that. And I think, again, that affirms the very point of this book, that God rules in the kingdoms of men. He can exalt who He wants, He can take down who He wants, and He can do so in the way that He wants, whether it be in military battle or someone dying by means of disease. It can take place. Now, going back to the text, David, that you were referring to, verses 13 and 14, regarding this onslaught on the city of Jerusalem, it says at verse 13, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said unto that certain one who spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the continual burnt offering and the transgression that maketh desolate to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot?" Now that's a legitimate question, isn't it? From the historical standpoint, noting what Antiochus did, the question is justly asked, just how long is this going to continue? And the response is in verse 14, "And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 evenings and mornings, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." So we have a beginning point and an ending point, a time when the sanctuary would be cleansed. Now how do we fit that into the numbers? The vision of the evenings and the mornings. I think the number of the days the sacrifices would cease and the temple would be desolated. Perhaps a literal period, and I think probably a literal period a little over 6 years, corresponding to the actual period of time the abomination of Antiochus Epiphanes occurred. And that would be from about 171 to about 164 or 5. Daniel instructed to seal up the vision. Now, Terry, that's an interesting statement. He and I have talked about that, how that Daniel is instructed to seal up the vision, for it was to occur, quote, many days in the future. That is, almost 400 years after the time that Daniel writes. David.
What John was told in Revelation.
Yes.
He's told to 24.
Yes, okay, and that...
Of course, he's also, like you pointed out, was the... you know, Daniel, it says it's many days in the future. We're not, it's at hand.
That's right.
The opposite language.
Yeah. Lord, come quickly. Yeah, it's at hand. Now, Gabriel is assigned to explain the vision. Now, you would think that when Gabriel explains the vision, any questions we would have, that he would just take care of that, wouldn't you? But let's look at the explanation. Verse 15. It says, "And it came to pass when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision, that I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulay, which called, and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision." Now, I was thinking today that it would be nice if I could just have someone to call and make me understand this. I got tickled at Richard a little while ago. I was expressing to him some questions that I had. He said, "Well, you know, Deuteronomy 29:29 answers a lot of questions. And if you don't know what that says, you need to turn and look that up, and you'll find out." But Gabriel is to make this man understand the vision. Verse 17, "So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was affrighted and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, Understand, O son of man, for the vision belongeth to the time of the end." Now let's pause there. The vision is something that Daniel just doesn't get. It's desirable that Daniel would understand it. Yes, Terry?
The last half of verse 17 says, how did that read?
Okay, let me just read the whole verse so we'll get it all. "So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was affrighted and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, Understand, O son of man, for the vision belongeth to the time of the end." Okay. Okay. I think that's probably the same thing. Yeah, that'll work. That'll work. So when there stood before him one having the appearance of a man, and a man's voice from the banks saying unto Gabriel to make Daniel understand. Now Gabriel speaks to Daniel. And as he speaks to Daniel, it prompts Daniel to fall on his face in fear and trembling, telling him the vision refers to the time of the end. I think that's what you're talking about. And he stands Daniel on his feet, for Daniel had fallen into a deep sleep with his face to the ground. Now, to tell him what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. And you remember that the theme of the book, as we've identified earlier, is God rules in the kingdoms of men. And so it is regarding the end. Now we'll talk a little bit further down the pike about what end in particular he is identifying. He's not talking about the end of time. He's talking about the sequence of these kings and God appointing a time for the end of these kings. Now we'll notice that as we get a little further down the pike. David?
In your references, did you read anything about the end of persecution of the days of
2300 days?
Is six and some odd year. And the one guy I was reading pointed out that six and, seven means complete.
Right, right.
And six and a half means it was not complete. So he didn't have the complete authority or the complete control.
Yeah.
God had the last eight. He didn't let it go until that seventh year.
Yeah. I read that. The arguments, I thought, as far as the symbolic language of the text, I wasn't convinced. But at any rate, I did read that, and it has possibilities. That is one understanding of it. Any other comment or question before we get back? Yes, Randy?
I just thought it was worthy of note that Gabriel is also the name of the angel who spoke to Mary.
That is true, yes. Yes, that's in what, Luke chapter 1?
Luke chapter 1, verse 18 and verse 26.
It is noteworthy to see that in this historical time setting, we have the same angel as we do centuries later.
Or at least one with the same name.
Well, at least one with the same name, yes. That's true. That's true. There may be many Mickeys running around somewhere, isn't there? That is a marvel, isn't it? Okay? That is true. Now, Gabriel explains the vision. In chapter 8, verse 20, it says, "The ram which thou sawest, that had the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia." Now, that's easy, isn't it? And we've noted that the larger horn of Daniel 8, verse 3, may represent Persia's greater influence. And the expansion of the Medo-Persian Empire is illustrated by the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, as we read in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 4. And this represents the territory, or a map of the Medo-Persian Empire. And you'll notice that it does, someone mentioned it, I think David, you or someone, that it not only encompasses the land of Palestine, but it also extends down into the region of Egypt, to show the expanse and the extent of it. The one-horned male goat in Daniel chapter 8, verse 21 is also easily identified. And the rough he-goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, again, that's not hard. The horn represented the first king, which of course would be Alexander the Great. And we've seen in the 8th chapter at verse 5 the rapid speed at which Alexander's conquests take place. Alexander defeated the Persian in 3 decisive battles, and you can see these on the board. Another interesting thing as far as the history of this is concerned, we'll get away from this history a little bit in just a moment and get back to this text that I have some questions about. And that is that the land of Palestine changed hands 5 times after the death of Alexander. I thought that was just an interesting tidbit of information that we needed to be aware of. Some of that resulted in the development of the Samaritans. Can somebody give me the history of the Samaritan people? We've studied that. Where they came from?
And they were planted by the Assyrian king.
Okay. And
that area in place of the Jewish people that were there.
Okay. Okay, they claimed to worship God, and you're right, the Assyrians, in a sense, brought them in. What they did is conquered other nations, and they would mix and mingle the people. Anybody who had any ability, any power, any authority, any wealth, or such things as that, which might lead to a possible uprising, they would uproot them, take what they had, and transplant them someplace where they had nothing. And so the possibilities of an uprising were... they were just squashed. You wouldn't expect that.
What I read too, the ones that were smart and the leaders, they took back to to their land.
Right.
So they didn't leave any good leaders.
Right. That's right. So we've got this mixing and mingling, and I hate to use the expression, but for illustrative purposes, they would mix and mingle the nobodies of the kingdom, to the extent that there wouldn't be anybody to lead an uprising. And when they conquered the land of Palestine, they brought in people from other places. And they left those that were nobodies, even among the Jews. And this intermarriage that began to take place resulted then in the development of the Samaritans. Now the Samaritans, because of their relationship with Jews, thought that they had learned God. And interestingly enough, their thinking, as Richard has pointed out, was influenced by a certain priest who was brought back from Assyrian captivity to educate these people. Now, we might justly ask the question, why were these people taken into captivity to begin with? Why were the Israelite people taken into captivity to start with? What was it they were doing?
They were worshiping idols.
And God had told them repeatedly that when you worship idols, here's what's going to happen to you. You'll be taken into captivity. And so they were. Now, just for a point of emphasis, what do you think that this priest knew about God?
Not very much.
And he's come back now to educate the inhabitants of this land about God. And if you'll turn in your Bible to 2 Kings chapter 17, I would just encourage you to read the chapter. But what we find them doing as a result of the education of this priest is very telling. Because what we find them doing is worshiping God right along with their other gods. Now that's what this priest had taught them to do. That's what they knew about the one God that we know as the one true and living God. No other God. But they didn't understand it that way. They understood that you just add Jehovah to your list of gods that you worship, and that's what they were practicing. Now in with the whole chapter? Just hold it there for a minute. Let me get this point in. If we have time, we'll throw that in, okay? In John, the fourth chapter, there was a long time that I didn't understand what John was teaching or what Jesus was teaching the Samaritans until I began to reflect upon the history of the Samaritan people. When the Samaritans raised the question that we worship here, you worship there. And Jesus is emphasizing the point that there will come a time when it won't make any difference where you worship, because God is a spirit, and they that worship shall worship, or they that worship Him shall worship in spirit and in truth. But in that mix, in chapter 4, verse 21, Jesus said, "Ye worship that which ye know not. We worship that which we know." Now that's a remarkable statement when you consider it in the historical setting of the development of the Samaritans. Their knowledge of God was zip from the beginning, but they had built a temple in Mount Gerizim to worship God. But they worshiped God as if He was just one of many gods. And so when Jesus said, "Ye worship that which ye know not," the question legitimately has to be asked, did they really know God? No, they never had really known God. From the very beginning of their knowledge of God, it was one as a notch on the gun barrel. They just didn't really have any proper concept of only one God. And so Jesus' statement, "Ye worship that which ye know not," takes on added significance in this historical setting of the time that we're talking about. Now, Randy, go ahead if you'd like to read that.
Yeah, 2 Kings 17, 27 through 33. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, "Take there one of the priests whom you carried away into exile, and let him go and live there, and let him teach the custom of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they carried away into exile from Samaria came and lived in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. But every nation still made gods of its own and put them in the houses of the high places which the people of Samaria had made, every nation in their cities in which they lived. And the men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth, the men of Cuth made Nergal, the men of Hamath made Ashimah, and the Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak, and the Sepharites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anammelech, the gods of the Sepharvaim. They also feared the Lord and appointed from among themselves priests of the high places who act for them in the houses of the high places. They feared the Lord and served their own gods according to the customs of the nations from among whom they had been carried away into exile.
So their understanding of God was completely different. They even appointed a new priesthood. David?
I was going to say, it really goes all the way back to Jeroboam. When he came back from Egypt, he brought back a lot of the idol worship and stuff. And they made the 10 tribes broke away, and he had the high places even then and stuff. And God promised that the king would come down through that kingdom because he would do the right thing, but he didn't.
Right. Another comment. Richard, am I out of time? I wanted to make another comment. I want you to study carefully verses 21 through the end of this chapter, because that's where we're going to start next time. Verses 21 through the end of the chapter. And let's see if we can nail some things down real good and solid. Another thing that I'd like for you to think about is the significance of this time frame that we're studying, and the changes that take place in this time frame, and the significance of those changes to the things we're going to want to be talking about in the next few chapters. Now, a question that I have to ask is, I notice in a study such as Daniel versus our study on Bible authority, had lots of comments and questions in Bible authority, not having a whole lot of comment or question per se from the study of the book of Daniel. That's of interest to me. And I suppose the reason is I want this to be an interesting study to you. I want it to be one that's beneficial and profitable to you, and I want you to study Because if you don't, then it's just going to be a dull, dry bunch of comments from two or three in the class, and nobody else will know where we are or what we're talking about. So you study this information, and it'll be helpful to you, I think, to understand a little bit more about a book that we might not be as familiar with as we are other books of the Bible. Okay?